So I was here, the last time I was here, last time I spoke to your Sangha, I talked about the five recollections, which are these, you know, five contemplations that the Buddha encouraged his followers to pay attention to often, actually daily. And I mentioned then that the first three of these recollections relate to what are often called the heavenly messengers or the divine messengers. And probably I would guess that most of you are familiar with these. The story is probably familiar to you. The Buddha's father was supposedly told by an astrologer or a soothsayer that when the Buddha was born, that his son would either become a great king or a great spiritual teacher. And the father, being himself some kind of royal, some powerful person, he had definite preferences, you know, about that choice. And so he protected the Buddha from encountering anything that would be difficult for him in the first 28 years of his life, encouraging him to find his happiness in the satisfaction of sense desires, which, you know, maybe that sounds kind of familiar to you. I think it's kind of how often in the Western world we're encouraged to find happiness. And then the story goes that the Buddha sneaked out of the palace when he was 28 years old to see what the world was like beyond the gates. And he was in a chariot with his charioteer, and he encountered somebody who was ill, somebody who was old, and someone who had died. And each time he was kind of shocked, and he asked his charioteer, "So what is this?" And the charioteer told him and explained that all people are subject to these three things, sickness, old age, and death, kind of the three biggest ways that humans experience, three most dramatic anyway, ways that humans experience impermanence in their lives. So I think of it kind of as a story about growing up. You know, the Buddha was innocent. That's the story anyway. The Buddha was innocent in the way that small children can be innocent, not knowing about these three kind of basic facts of life that are quite challenging. And leaving the palace walls, he chose to grow up, you know. He decided to see what was true about life. And then, of course, the fourth messenger that the Buddha encountered on that trip outside the walls was a monk walking upright and calm and steady with great dignity in his simple robes and carrying an alms bowl. And the monk, of course, represents the possibility of escape from the suffering that we people experience when we're confronted with these three facts of life. In my sense, I might have said this last time that I spoke to you, because it's something that I mention a lot. My sense for a long time has been that almost all the dukkha in my life comes from resistance to the truth of impermanence. Thich Nhat Hanh once said, "It is not impermanence that makes us suffer. What makes us suffer is wanting things to be permanent when they are not." And that seems to me to be pretty accurate. So if you were present last time, or if you know the five recollections, you'll remember that these first three messengers are the messages of the first three recollections. I'm subject to illness. Illness is unavoidable. I am subject to aging. Aging is unavoidable. I am subject to death. Death is unavoidable. And then the fourth of the recollections, which kind of summarizes the way these, you know, the essential effect of impermanence plays out in our lives over a lifetime, is I will one day be separate from all that I hold dear and love, all that I love and hold dear. So the Buddha story goes on to tell us that seeing these four messengers prompted the Buddha to leave his home and search for freedom. And I have the sense that the Buddha probably believed that if people were willing to seriously contemplate these three messengers, that they would respond in the same way. They would turn away from looking for happiness in the satisfaction of sense desires to something a little bit more reliable, you know, a kind of freedom that that takes us out of this spinning wheel of always trying to get what we want, always trying to get what we want. So the intention behind both these three messengers, all four messengers, and the recollections that I talked about last time, is that they'll spur us to look outside the wheel of desire for freedom. And I think that's why we call these facts the heavenly or divine messengers, these facts of life, because they point us toward a freedom that's outside of our worldly satisfactions. And in our tradition, the insight tradition of Buddhism, based in the Theravada, liberation arises through insights into the truths of our existence. We speak of insights into anicca, impermanence, dukkha, suffering, stress, and anatta, the sense of not self. They're not being a solid self in this flow of experience. And of those three, the insight that's most often pointed to as leading to awakening is the insight into anicca, inconstancy, as Gil Fronsdahl often calls it, the pervasiveness of change, impermanence, is the way it's usually translated. So, as I know, I said the last time that I spoke to your Sangha, I think we often have a kind of deluded belief that we already know, you know, about impermanence. We really, you know, we've got it nailed. We know exactly how things come, they go. Life has all those kinds of changes. But intellectually knowing that it's true, believing in it, it's not the same thing as insight. Insight really often arises kind of suddenly from a sudden change in perception, sometimes often as a surprise, with a kind of sense of, oh, yeah, of course, how could I have missed that? Suddenly something seems really obvious to us, something that was hiding in plain sight. And it's kind of like, I've actually heard it described this way, and I think it's really accurate. Those magic eye or stereogram designs, you remember those? I think they were popular about 20 years ago or so. There'd be a picture that was just geometric shapes, so maybe some paisleys or maybe parallelograms or stars or something, and they'd be on a field, and it would just look like a kind of an abstract design. But then if you looked at it just right, if you kind of softened your focus a little bit and just moved your head a little bit, all of a sudden what would just pop out to you would be a dinosaur or a flower or a boat or something that was hidden in plain sight in this design. And once you saw it, then anytime you looked back at that same design, you would see it again. You know, it might take a long time to see it. Sometimes, days of looking at something and going back and thinking, I don't know, I don't see anything there. But once it was there, you know, you couldn't miss it anymore. And that's kind of like, insight is sort of like that. I think, you know, it comes through our mindful attention to what's happening, what's actually hiding in plain sight. And at some point, what was hidden reveals itself. We can't make it happen, but we can create conditions that are conducive to it happening. So last Friday morning, Gil Fronsdahl, you know how he's been doing these meditations followed by a short Dharma talk, a little Dharmet every weekday since the pandemic started. Well, last Friday, he spoke about his sense that in order, and it was also part of a retreat that was going on at the same time, a short retreat online. He spoke about his sense that in order to be prepared for deep insight into anicca, we need to cultivate its opposite. We need to cultivate stability, steadiness. And it's something, this is something he often speaks about. Actually, he's the only Dharma teacher I know who kind of approaches these three characteristics in this way by cultivating their opposites. I think it's really worth exploring. It's really useful, really useful. And so that's why I'm talking about it tonight. As he often says, we don't practice impermanence. We see it. But to be able to fully and completely come into harmony with it, as a chant, an impermanence chant says, to come into harmony with the truth of impermanence, with the movement, the flux, the change that's just going on all the time, and not be blown away by it, not to become afraid and retreat into, some kind of distracting activity. We have to develop inner stability. And when Birgit invited me to come and speak to you again, I immediately had the idea, I'll talk about this, the cultivation of stability, because it's a natural kind of companion, I think, to the working with the five recollections. Because in order to really embrace the truth of those recollections, there needs to be stability present. Otherwise, they can just be kind of ways to torture ourselves, kind of beat ourselves up. But coming into harmony with the truth of inconstancy, it requires stability in the mind and in the heart. And I think of it as having two different flavors. One is a kind of stability that's like a mountain. Sometimes we talk about that, being like a mountain in meditation, solid, unmoving, really just powerful in that way. And the other kind of stability that I think about is a kind of flexibility, like the way a strong tree is in a windstorm, a tree that has flexibility in its branches, and it can bend and then it can come back into balance. And there are some trees like eucalyptus trees, for instance, they grow really tall and straight, but they have a tendency to break. Their branches have a tendency to break because the wood is very dense. It's really, really stiff and dense. So a strength that has more flexibility in it is more conducive to resilience when the wind is really moving. And I think that's true for us as well. And someone I was talking to recently, another Dharma practitioner, she described emotional resilience as being like a buoy in the ocean. And I thought that simile worked really well for this kind of stability. It's a way of maintaining balance. Sometimes when the sea is calm, the buoy just floats and it's very peaceful. Nothing is moving very much. And sometimes when it's really stormy and there are big waves, the buoy might get knocked around by them, might get knocked completely over, but then it comes back to center, because it comes back to uprightness, because even though it's sitting in the midst of all this turbulence on the surface, it's anchored to the seabed, the stable, steady seabed. And I think that describes, a kind of resilience, a kind of equanimity, really, the kind that is translated into English as standing in the middle of all this. Tatra majitata is the Pali word, standing in the middle of all this. And that's the kind of steadiness that I think we cultivate in our practice. So with everything that's going on in the world today, it's really natural to find our minds moved by all kinds of waves, waves of different emotional states and of being maybe distracted. I know I've been feeling a lot of distraction lately. I noticed, I was doing something and I went to the kitchen to get a cup of tea and then I completely forgot what I was doing. Things like that are happening quite often. Might be aging as well. That's causing that, but in difficulty focusing, obsessively thinking, planning, there are all kinds of effects of stress that are showing up in us. And finding a place of stability within is a kind of ballast against all these tendencies that move us around. It gives us that anchor to keep us from getting you know, really swamped, wrecked, moved over so that we can't get back up. So my focus tonight, I really wanted to focus on the way that cultivating stability can help us in daily life right now, more than in our deep meditation practice, although it's really useful for both. But that's, I just wanted to focus on that because we're in the midst of this, you know, the pandemic, the polarization in the country, all the political things that are going on. It's very, there's a lot of waves. There are really a lot of waves. And both of these kinds of stability can help. In both areas, I think, in the more flexible kind, you know, is maybe more helpful in our daily life activities. And then the deep stillness and rootedness of a mountain, that maybe is more useful when we're in solitude, when we're in contemplation, when we're practicing formal meditation. So our Buddhist practice, of course, I think everything in our Buddhist practice really helps us to develop stability, steadiness. You know, that's part of the path to freedom, and it comes along naturally. But I wanted to focus on some specific tools tonight. So I'm just going to suggest a few things that I think are really useful. And you might just see, you know, if one or another is, you know, feels resonant with you and your particular kind of practice and the way you live your life. I think the practice of mindfulness, the first thing, the practice of mindfulness is a practice of stability. You know, Pema Chodron calls it learning to stay. I like that. It's a really good kind of phrase, I think, learning to stay. She talks about staying on the dot, you know, just being right here on the dot, not running away from what's arising. It's very similar, I think, to, you know, Gil often uses the word here as just a one word note that just reminds us to stay right where we are. So we learn to stay when there are stormy emotions, you know, when there's a whirl of thinking in the mind and when our body is feeling agitated and really wants to move, there's a lot of restlessness. So staying, being able to just stay, is a practice that cultivates stability. It's kind of, you know, makes sense. And it's also a way of expressing stability when we're able to stay, to stick with our object of meditation, to stick with the meditation when things are really turbulent. That's, you know, it builds strength to do that. When we're in the midst of strong emotion or challenging mental states and can stay with them, it's creating that connecting rope that the buoy, you know, is connected to the seabed with. And grounding our awareness in the solidity of the body, you know, that's another, I was talking about just our practice of mindfulness, and now, you know, really focusing on the body is the second kind of tool, I think, for developing stability. The grounding in our physicality, it's that, I think, for me, is the most powerful way of cultivating this sense of steadiness. When the mind is kind of being tossed around by waves of worry or anger, fear, all those different things, the body can be, you know, it can be a solid anchor for us. When we sit for meditation, we can take a posture that, like I suggested this evening, that's dignified, you know, manifesting that kind of physical steadiness, that sort of mountain-like steadiness. Often we speak of sitting like a mountain, and bodily stillness, we know bodily stillness also has a tendency to encourage mental stillness. Our minds and our bodies are intimately related. And when we're able to still the body, to remain still through the storms that go on, and looking on the storms kindly, as Gil also often encourages, then that bodily stillness can be the anchor that keeps the buoy of the mind from getting washed away by the waves. And when we're engaged in activities, you know, household activities, daily activities, outside, inside, wherever, we can attend to our posture And we can really feel the weight of our body on our feet, really attend to the solidity of our body, ground ourselves, so to speak. You know, that's, we talk about grounding ourselves a lot. And it has a similar effect, I think. It gives our minds a kind of stable platform that they can rest on. And the breath is part of the body, of course. Breathing in a steady and calm way, you know, breathing, maybe lengthening the breath, especially lengthening the out breath. I know lengthening the out breath actually has neurological effects, physiological effects. It engages the parasympathetic nervous system, which has a calming influence on our whole system, our whole nervous system. Accentuating the out breath, making it long. It's a really useful tool, I think, for steadying ourselves. And then movement practices like yoga also, I think they also have the effect. The posture of Tadasana, you know, the standing mountain pose, even has that name, mountain, which is the kind of foundation pose in yoga. It's kind of a bodily manifestation of this inner stability, this steadiness, this rootedness. I think a lot of poses in yoga are builders of stability because there's a tension between a kind of dynamism in the holding the posture and then the outer stillness that contains it. It really cultivates, I think, a sense of steadiness. And then cultivating virtue, you know, ethical life, ethical sensitivity, practicing harmlessness in our actions, that also is a tool in this cultivation. Living our lives in alignment with ethical precepts, determining not to kill, not to steal, not to lie, not to misuse our sexuality, not to intoxicate our minds. There's this inner sense of integrity and wholeness that can develop within us. Regret and remorse, you know, that which are kind of agitating mental states, they're not likely to visit us when we live an ethical life. There's a kind of uprightness that we develop. We respect ourselves more, and there's just steadiness in that. And along the same lines, you know, the cultivation of beautiful mental qualities like the Brahmaviharas, love the Brahmaviharas, and the Paramis. I don't know that we give enough attention to the Paramis really quite often. And they're really important qualities like resolution, patience, renunciation, generosity, metta is one of them, loving kindness, equanimity, truthfulness. There's a couple more. Energy, wisdom. They're a list of 10, you know, perfections that are, all of them are really wholesome qualities that lead to a sense of integrity again and wholeness, which is, you know, they give us ballast, they give us weight, they give us that steadiness. I think they're really useful for working with anxiety. And, you know, so many people are feeling really a lot of anxiety in this period. And the Paramis, they can all of them, I think, can act as antidotes to anxiety. We can stay on the dot with the feelings in the body that anxiety produces, and at the same time call on patience, you know, or call on determination, persistence to give us some strength. There really isn't anything in our practice that doesn't really tend in this direction, I think. And as we go about our days, it's also really useful to pay attention to the things that disturb us when there is a sense of, you know, a sense of steadiness, a sense of balance in our minds and bodies. Notice what it is that that takes us away from that, what subverts our steadiness. You know, sometimes it can be too much news, you know, too much news that we've watched or listened to or read, or other things that we take in through our senses. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh, when he speaks about the precepts, the fifth precept, which is the precept against intoxication, mental intoxication, he talks about other things besides alcohol and drugs, which is usually what are mentioned. He talks about the things that we take in through reading, watching television or online things, all the ways that we take in the culture, you know, and the social stuff around us, all those things can also intoxicate us, and that moves us out of a sense of stability. And last month when I introduced the five recollections, part of the intention that I had was to encourage you to notice the ways that we react to them. You know, when we hear, I am subject to illness, I have not gone beyond illness. How do we respond to that? If there's resistance, if there's aversion, that can point to areas where stability is missing in our kind of meetings with Nietzsche, with change. And using them as a meditation object, you know, it's also a way of developing the stability. So using them has a power to kind of help us see that where we waver when we're trying to be steady, and also it helps us to develop a kind of unwavering heart and mind. Another thing that Thich Nhat Hanh said once, he was talking about the boats, you know, after the end of the Vietnam War, there were really a lot of refugees who left Vietnam in these really small, not seaworthy boats. And they were out in, you know, into the Gulf of Siam and into open ocean, you know. And he said, when the crowded refugee boats met with storms or pirates, if everyone panicked, all would be lost. But if even one person stayed calm, it was enough. It showed the way for everyone to survive. So I that's always really inspired me. And I think it points to the way that cultivating this inner strength for ourselves, you know, it's really useful for our own meeting of challenges of life. It also serves others, you know, it can spread out, it can be sort of contagious. 2 years ago, in April, my husband had a heart attack, and was kind of a heavenly messenger for both of us. He was in England at the time. He comes from there originally, although he's really Irish, but he grew up in England. And he was visiting his brother, who had a heart attack, coincidentally, 2 weeks earlier. So they ended up, both of them were in the hospital at the same time. And I was here in California when it happened. And, you know, as you can imagine, it really tested our any kind of inner stability that we had. And my husband's niece took him to the hospital in the middle of the night. My husband woke up, and he very calmly went to the bedroom where my niece was sleeping with her mom, my husband's sister-in-law. And he knocked on the door and he said, you know, I think I'm having a heart attack. He was very calm about it. And they couldn't believe it. You know, how unlikely is that to happen 2 weeks after his brother had one? But later, after everything had sort of sorted itself out a couple of weeks later, his niece who took him to the hospital, she was so struck. She shared with us how struck she was by how my husband seemed serene through all the stuff he went through. You know, he had all kinds of catheterization procedures and stents, and it was, you know, it was really difficult, really kind of stressful thing. But the whole time he had good humor and he had serenity. And she was really impressed by that. And his sister-in-law also commented on it. And his staying calm, just like the guys in the boats that Thich Nhat Hanh spoke about, his staying calm through this little storm in his life really helped them to be a support and calmer supports to my husband's brother, who had a much more complicated stuff going on than my husband had. So my husband's state was really a help to those near him, just in a very practical way. And I think that's part of, it's part of what we develop, the ability to be, just to be a support to others in really simple ways due to this development of stability. So last weekend, I was assisting on the retreat that Gil taught, online over the weekend. And the topic was the three characteristics, or as sometimes Gil calls them, the three perspectives, which I kind of like. Anicca, dukkha, anatta. These three characteristics that characterize our experience of life. And the approach that he took was to emphasize this cultivation of the opposites of all three of them. So again and again, he made the point that in order to have deep insight into any one of these truths, it's really important we don't practice it, the truth, we practice its opposite. To be prepared for the insight into dukkha, the truth of suffering, of stress, we cultivate a sense of well-being, inner well-being. To be prepared for insight into not self, anatta, the second, actually the third of the insights, we cultivate confidence, self-confidence, something we often don't think about in Buddhism. So I highly recommend you listen to Gil talk about it because it's very useful. And to be prepared for insight into anicca, this, impermanence, inconstancy, instability, which is the root kind of the other two, we practice its opposite. We practice this stability. We cultivate stability. So, so it's an important part. It's a really essential part, cultivating stability, of our meditation path, our meditative path to insight, to awakening. But what I really wanted to emphasize tonight was that this same steadiness, this same stability really serves us in every aspect of our outer lives as well, our relational lives, our daily lives. And right now, when the whole world seems to be kind of in huge waves of change, it helps us meet these unpredictable, challenges, things like heart attacks, pandemic disease, like the animosity that's pervading the political system in our country, and the racism that's built into the structures, the very structures of our society. And it also helps us to meet the more subtle challenges in our inner life, the difficult emotions, the obsessive thinking, the worry. The stability can be a balance to that. It can help us to deal with it in a calmer, more tranquil way. And that same cultivation that prepares us to see deeply, into the changing nature of our experience in a way that actually leads to liberation, to liberating insight. It also prepares us to meet these really, to the more mundane expressions of inconstancy that we just come up against every day, when something breaks, when we stub our toe, when something really simple happens. The same stability, the same kind of strength is helpful to us, It's just like, it's like the Dharma. It's good in the beginning, it's good in the middle, and it's good at the end as well. So that's what I have to say about stability.